purposely sit and take notes of everything rather than let me zap and attack your attention to learn it later. You know, it's rather like substituting for the reading of a book, taking a Xerox of it. I mean, it doesn't make the book read just because you have it all written down. You have the two readings from the first lecture. The readings for this lecture are three. The most important one is a chapter from the book of Avo, A-A-B-O-E, which is on your reading list, and that I have duplicated so you shan't all queue up for it, because it's desirable you get that early. If you are interested in this stuff, you don't have to do it, but if you want to read about the fascinating stuff that I have for today on Babylonian civilization, there are two paperbacks that I would advise you to get and read, either from the library where they're on reserve or from your friendly neighborhood paperback bookshop. They are the books listed in your bibliography by Chiera and by Kramer. They tell you and show you pictures of the Babylonian civilization. History begins at Sumer, and they wrote on clay. They Wrote on Clay is a rather popular one. Kramer is a little more advanced. Orbo's book, if you have no horror of the mathematics, is pretty ideal for this Babylonian and several of the other things we shall do. You are required to get the two textbooks, one, of course, by me, the other by Mason. Those you'll find in the co-op. If anybody notices that there aren't copies, try Book World, or we'll get them to order again, just let me know. Well, try Book World, tell them to reorder, or I'll call them and have them reorder. But, yes? That's on the table here. You can collect it at the end of the lecture. Okay. By about 5,000 years ago, that is round about 3,000 BC, the hunter-gatherers had been steadily converted into first agricultural villages, each of them 10 to 1,000 times larger in concentration than man had ever been before at the wild tribe stage. But the big advance was in something that was as much bigger than the agricultural villages as the villages were larger than the tribes. These were these particularly lush, peculiar areas that became megalopolitan centers for the very beginning of civilization. The things that really formed civilization as we know it, there was doubtless a change, an enormous change in social function going from the tribe to the settled agricultural village. But since at the same time there were growing these great river valley civilizations, that change overreaches that of the agricultural villages. Now, the four places that we have to consider are, of course, the Nile, that is now Egypt, the Tigris-Euphrates double river valley system, particularly good and concentrated since you had the marshland between the two rivers. That is now all of the region in what is modern Iraq, around Baghdad, for example. A word of warning, it is so different now because of ecological damage that you wouldn't recognize it if you could see it in 3000 BC. For example, every time you improve a river by dredging, by straightening, and so on, you push it back. I mean, we have an example right here in New Haven where the old harbor in the earliest days, came up to where Macy's and Mallie's is now. When they were digging the foundations, they discovered the piles. But they kept improving the harbour, so it went further and further away. And when they added the railroad for further improvement, that pushed it, so it is now about a mile further out from its original colonial way. Well, the Tigris-Euphrates civilization is 150 miles north of the present coastline. The 150 miles of marshland were laid down through the damage caused by man's agriculture. And this is, of course, why it is now a relatively infertile area, partly that and partly leaching. So, in the old days, it is 150 miles further north of where it is, and a very rich and lush valley. The same with the Indus in what is now modern Pakistan, and the Yellow River in the north of China. Now, I am going to talk today about the one out of those four civilizations that behaved anomalously. Now, it may seem strange to talk about anomaly when we only have four instances, but compared with all the other independent cultures that we have on the dissecting board of history, there is one where a most striking and determinative peculiarity happened. It is something that gave the entire character to modern science because of a quaint historical accident. This accident happened to the Mesopotamian civilization of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, double river valley, and it happened fairly near the beginning. All of the other civilizations, Egypt, Indus, Yellow River, and the later civilizations that grew up from the villages as they got larger and became towns, all of these are relatively normal civilizations where the normal sciences and technology flourished. They all developed, each in their own different way, but at very much the same sort of pace, not at exactly the same time, but considering that we're dealing with 5,000 years ago, some reasonable degree of synchronization. And they had comparable levels of technology and of science. The same types of things happened, not necessarily in exactly the same way. Let me just outline it. We'll be dealing with it in later lectures as we come to the other civilizations. But, as I pointed out in dealing with the Neolithic Revolution, simply in the course of eating and drinking and surviving, people learned the technologies of what plants were what, which were good food and ample and which were bad, how to select. Similarly, for medicines, for herbs, and all the things that you eat when you're unwell. Similarly, for the calendar, in this striking cycle of the year that afflicts the way of living of any nature people, one had to become sensitive to the calendar, and one became much more sensitive when you were engaged in agriculture rather than in gathering. You had to sow and reap at the right times. Then again, in the finding the properties of materials, I mean, salt, metals, all the other stuffs out of which you make things, the right sorts of clay, the right sorts of reeds, the right sorts of wood. People became skillful, and of course that knowledge was passed on so that we get a sort of folk botany, folk medicine, a folk zoology, folk knowledge of chemical material, and stuff like that. There is also development of a law code, development of a corpus of legends and mythology, and akin to magic, but not having that superstitious connotation that we put upon the term, there was developed a knowledge of omens, of things that were fortunate or unfortunate, that was just as reasonable and just as scientific as their knowledge of the calendar or of plants or medicines that we now accept. Now, the Fertile Crescent, a crescent running through what we know in our heritage as the Bible Lands, begins maybe 5,000 BC, but by about 3,000, we know it in an historical instead of a prehistoric fashion. Because the crucial thing that happened with the beginning of the megalopolitan centers was the invention of writing. And it is without question that the invention of writing and its spread, which probably takes 1,000 years, influenced enormously the development of language itself and the amount of communication, and altered radically the nature of civilization by giving us some content of culture that was a corpus handed on other than by a single person-to-person link of mother to child or father to child or to apprentice or child in the extended sense, instead of merely passing on a folk knowledge of how you do it and what you use, as was in folk medicine, as in the law, as in everything else. When the organization became more complex and more people were involved, it is the bureaucracy that came in that forced the establishment of a culture. Very clearly, the first use of writing was bureaucratic. The earliest documents we have for many centuries are simply what we rather vulgarly call laundry lists. That is, it looks like a list of people's names or classes of things followed by a number. John Smith, 4 goats. Harry Jones, 5 sheep. What is it? Presumably, it is what they had to pay or chose to give to the priesthood, the establishment, the rulers. A word of warning, you must be very careful not to interpret back to antiquity any of the words like priests and kings that we now have. There is a quite different connotation. Until about the 17th century, the church was what we would call city and state government. It was not a place where you went to say prayers. The emphasis was not upon the theological, mystic, life after death, praying to God type of thing. The priests were the civil administrators and organizers, and the religion was the concept that held the people together. It is a very different thing to what happened some considerable time after the more formal types of religion that came in with late Judaism, Christianity, and the Muslim faith. So, at any rate, you have a priesthood, but we would call them civil servants. And the civil servants were, of course, the ones who would organize, essentially, the redistribution of food during the non-working months, when the store food was handed out. And it was in that cause that writing began, and it is no small wonder that it is not the written words that developed a full complexity first, it is arithmetic and numerals, because that was the very stuff of accounting for the goods of the state. Civilization begins and practically ends with taxes. And this is what it was all about. We are lucky that for this area of Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, we have, but only rather recently, a much more detailed knowledge than we have of any other civilization. You won't know much about it because although the archaeology began to be known from about 1900 onward, quite a lot of it was only reasonably well worked out by 1920 or 1930, and that is far too recent for it to have gotten into such admirable sources as Encyclopedia Britannica and the sort of books you would have had at high school. People are still blissfully unaware that modern civilization did not, as we used to think in our ethnocentric way, begin with the Greek miracle around the Mediterranean basin. The Mediterranean basin comes after the development of the river valley civilizations. In fact, the whole big Mediterranean basin becomes a huge, glorified, modified river valley civilization several centuries later than the others. The civilizations I'm talking about now were highly sophisticated when the Greeks were still in their caves. We know a lot about them because the archaeology from 1920 or 30 or so depends on the written word that is preserved not in fragile paper, papyrus, and vellum documents, but in tablets of clay. This is what the Bible calls tablets of stone. It doesn't really mean stone, it means clay, because essentially the Old Testament part of the Bible is Babylonian in origin. Rather late Babylonian, but still much out of this civilization. I'm going to hand round a few tablets of clay so you can see what they look like. If I start that one round here, and that one round here, and this little one I'm going to talk about is a multiplication table. And I'll start that there. Please don't drop them. Otherwise I will have to go up the mountain and collect some more. Paper, vellum, papyrus are all very fragile. For most of history, there never were books in those materials more than 100 or maybe 200 years old. Even if they physically survived, which they often didn't, they fall to bits, one would change the handwriting and indeed the language so much in 3 or 4 or 5 generations that they would be as unreadable to the common man as, let us say, Chaucer, or perhaps even Shakespeare is to us. You would lose meaning of a great many words and change grammatical style. So that if any book from the past survives, it does so only because people copied and recopied. Any book that was not copied about every 2 generations disappeared along the way. And until 1600 or so, if you had a better copy of a book, you threw away or destroyed the old one. Most of the tales that you hear of the destruction of libraries, including the Library of Alexandria, are totally untrue. I mean, the myth of the Library of Alexandria is a typical piece of racial propaganda warfare. The Muslims didn't do that sort of thing. They respected books as much as anyone. Fact was that culture took a holiday while everybody was at war, and by the time they came back, those books at Alexandria were useless. What there were, and there weren't very many, there were fewer books in Alexandria than would go into bookshelves around this room. It was a small library. What I want to illustrate by this is that our knowledge of the written word of the past is extremely fragmentary and is eclectic. That is, it is chosen from just those things that were such as to be recopied about every couple of generations, so that a great deal of what there used to be does not survive to us. For the Fertile Crescent, it is different. They happen to work in this most permanent of materials. If all of the Earth were wiped out by an outburst of the sort of nuclear holocaust that we have had nightmares about ever since World War II, if we were completely destroyed in fire blanket and nothing remained of our civilization, what would remain very nicely baked to perfection are the clay tablets in the sands of Mesopotamia. Relatively few have been dug up, only maybe 100,000 or so, but the ones that have been dug up illustrate that almost everything that exists, exists in many copies. It comes in many copies because they invented schools. And if you read the Cramer book, you will find the story of these first schools and how the administrative class, drawn from the richer, upper-class elite of the country, were sent to school and made to copy and recopy and do dreadful arithmetical examples to tedium to get it all right and pass on the technique that was the vital new thing that they had in civilization. If all of our culture were destroyed, then if the Martians came in 50,000 years' time and looked to see what civilization there were on Earth, they would be able to reconstruct the Babylonian civilization better than our own. Clay is non-biodegradable. It's there. It's the most lasting material ever. They wrote on it with a little stick sharpened in a sort of knife point, and pressing that on the clay could make signs. Now, undoubtedly, they started with funny little pictures. For example, they might have started with something like that, that said, bird. You know, the funny sort of bird you get in Mesopotamia. But then they would hold the tablet on the side, and it was more convenient for writing to write it that way. But then writing with a stick, instead of dragging it along and making pictures, with the little stick, you can make weird shape marks like that, and they'd make a pair there like that, and perhaps a pair like so, and out of up and down, side to side, and diagonal wedges, and also turning the stick around to the corner, they could make a little sign like that. Well, that's practically their alphabet. The signs that go like so, and like so, and like that, and like that. As you can see on the tablets that are coming around, they, by about 3000 BC, had 500 or 600 signs like that, that were a refinement of the previous drawn shapes that became standard, and by about 3000, something like 100 of those words, those ideographs, were sound syllables, so that you could put them together just to reproduce the sound of a word rather than its pictorial character. Now, so begins ideographic language. Modern Chinese, ancient Egyptian, are languages like this. This is the first stage of language. It is rather later, the next stage, that you go to the sound syllables alone and modify these into some sort of relatively simple alphabet of 20 or 30 different characters, which will combine for all words. It is much more economical to have some meaning words, like our use of the ampersand for and, or the special sign for etc., or stuff like that, that we still use, like the Chinese do. From 2000 or 1500 BC, when the early stage is over, we have already a language that is extremely complex, highly extended with grammar, and from 2200 BC, the previous Sumerians are conquered by a Semitic race, the Akkadians. So we go from the Sumerian language to the Akkadian, the Semitic, and that's about 2200 BC. And from that time onwards, you have all the richness of culture that comes when two different languages have merged and flown together, like the richness of the English language with its Latin and Anglo-Saxon mixed origins. You have the writing of Akkadian in Sumerian syllabaries. You have the conflation of the grammars and the names and the loan words, and language is complicated. So that by about this time, 2000 and after, 2000 BC and after, towards 1500 BC, one has the development of a complex literature. Now we know from this literature people for the first time. All that we had seen before are technologies changing slowly with time, and one gets the feeling of this very slow-moving, evolving historical development of technology. Suddenly we get real people whose names we know, whose lives we know, whose letters we have, whose mythology we have. And it is absolutely crystal clear that these are people like you and me. They are people with the same time span, the same hopes, emotions, disasters, the same questions arising politically and economically as they do for us. They are so similar that what we really do is to try and concentrate on the relatively small differences. People then, from that time onwards, when we know them well, 1500 BC, are very much like now. They are not more stupid than us. These are fellows and students of another college. These are not 10 classes behind us. Now, although that happened to the language, what is much more amazing and makes me shudder a little is the rate at which simple arithmetic became higher mathematics. The weird thing that happened is the development of an extremely sophisticated arithmetical system. In most of the rest of the world, people counted, because of our digits, either in tens if they wore shoes, or in twenties if they did not. It is said, again mainly as a racial slur, that there exist simple civilizations where they can only count to five, or even count one too many. One too many. This is absurd. Nobody does that. What goes wrong is that you tend to get nine separate words and symbols for the numerals 1 through 9. Then you get another different 9 numerals for 10, 20 through 90. Then maybe another 9 for 100, 200, 300, and then going on and on. This is the norm of the rather unimaginative civilizations. We are only slightly more imaginative in going to place value tens. What happened in the Babylonian system is, to begin with, a very simple 10-based system of writing. The little clay tablet that's going around, I could insist, and were I a good stiff teacher, I would do so, I could insist that you go behind the woodshed and not come out until you can read that clay tablet, because you can teach yourself to do it. The clay tablet goes like this. What do you think that means? Right. And what do you think that means? The next line reads that, followed by what does it say? 2:18. The next line reads, that will be no surprise to you. And I would imagine, now if you don't think you can do it, you flunked, get out the class. What would be there? One of those and another of those. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. Now, for yourself, you can supply the next line and the next line. And now there's going to be a little trouble, because we will go on until... What's that number? 7. And what do you think will be here? You're wrong. What is really here is... that. A 1 and a 3. Now what is going on is that very early in their civilization, it must have happened that they were dealing with units that happened to be multiples of something like 60 from each other. Now in our metric system, you think that the multiple measure is 10. It isn't really. I mean, we use centimeters and we use meters. Whoever uses decimeters. We don't normally go by tens. We have a small unit as big as a finger and a big unit like that, and then a bigger unit that's something like a mile. In weights, we have a little bitty weight and something that weighs a pound and something that weighs a ton. Or something like that, you see. Now, in biblical antiquity, they had all these cubits and talents and shekels and minas. Those of you that are good in your reading with the capital G will know about those things. A talent is 60 minas and a mina is 60 shekels. And it must have just happened like that, and they pick it because 60 is a very nice number. 60 is a nicer number to deal with than 10. Now, they are using a 10 system. They have this for their 10 units, and of course they'll just run these up. This, for example, would be 52. This simply means one lot of 60 and 3 over. And this thing that happens in the second millennium or third millennium BC in the Mesopotamian area is so much part of our culture that this is exactly where there begins the tradition of hours, minutes, and seconds, and also degrees, minutes, and seconds, that still comes down to us, the division into 60. Indeed, you can read this as one lot of 9 minutes, two lots are 18 minutes, and so on, and 7 lots are 1 hour and 3 minutes. Get the picture? Now, it needn't be that. You could say that this is minutes This is seconds, and this is minutes and seconds. Or that could be degrees, and degrees and minutes. We use the units of 60, they use them too. Now, that mechanical invention, very simple one, it's rather like the use of the 12 system in feet and inches, the use of dozens and gross, a different number base in modern language. They used one of the largest practical number bases. They did use the tens just as a convenience for writing, but they knew their numbers up to 60, and they had their multiplication tables up to 60 times 60. Now, I want you to do that reading of the Obo article, for I shall expect you, for exam purposes, to master it enough to do very simple Babylonian arithmetic all by yourself. Now, instead of having to draw out all these wages, I can write them in numbers. And I will expect you to be able to do the multiplication of 2,30 by 8,40. Now, what I mean by comma is the equivalent of what we call in 10 base decimal point. This means 2 lots of 60 and 30 over. This means 8 lots of 60 and 40 over. What you do not do is to say 2 lots of 60 are 120 and 30 over makes 150. That's being rather stupid about it. What they do is say, well, this is 2 times 840. Now you can easily get 2 times 840 by adding 840 and 840. What is 40 and 40? It's not 80, no such word. It's 1 and 20. That's 1 to carry. 2 lots of 8 are 16, and 1 to carry makes 17, so that's 17,20. That is 2 lots of 840. Now, 30 is half of 60, like 30 minutes is half an hour. And this means half of 840, which is 4,20. Add it up, and we'll get 21,40. That's the answer. Now, if you like, you can compute this back into decimals and compute that back into decimals and check it. However, if you read the thing properly in the little reading, you should be able to do this sort of arithmetic, and I would like you to get the feel for it, for doing arithmetic in somebody else's culture pattern. Ours is not universal and certainly not the best. Computers don't operate on our number base. They operate in twos or in other things. This operates in the base of 60. For homework, do that sum, and you should get that answer. If you don't, slap yourself on the wrist and try it again until you do. I hope I got it right. Now, working in a base of 60 is called sexagesimal arithmetic. From the word sexagesima, which is Latin for 60. At this point, I always make the note that once I taught this class for a whole year, and at the exam at the end, I discovered about 5 people still thought I was talking about sexy decimals. There is nothing sexy about these decimals, nothing decimal either. Word is sexagesimal, and that is the funny technique that came in before the time of Troy in the Aegean world, and started a remarkable tradition in our culture. We have text after text of multiplication tables like the little one that is going around, which is the 9x table that gives you 1x9, 2, 3, 4, up to 9x9, 10x9, 20x9, 30x9, up to 50x9. Because if you go up to 50x9, and you can add on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up to 9x9, you can get everything from 1 9 to 59 nines. And you never need more than 59, because 69's a 9. Just one place further on. Okay? So you never need to multiply by anything more than 59. And they had their multiplication tables for all the numbers that were, working them by adding up. More than that. They had tables of reciprocals, and we know, because we can see what they look like, we get a table that goes, written in the proper notation, of course. I'm just writing it this way because you're more used to it. 2 and 30, 3 and 20, 4 and 15, 5 and 12, 6 and 10. That's why base 60 is so very good. 7 would be very hairy, so they leave it out. 8? Now, can you guess what there will be in 8? Well, it has to be half of 15, and half of 15 is 7/30. There is place value, but nobody worries about the position of the decimal point. It is like when you work with a calculator and you're not using scientific notation, you just care to get the numbers right. You can always get the decimal point right later. 7/30 means 7.5, or it means 7 lots of 60 and 30 over, or 7 lots of 60 times 60 and 30 sixties over, or 7/60 and 30 over 60 times 60. You can move it any number of places you want. 9 will be 1/3 of 3, and that will be 6 2/3, which is 40. 10 will be 6. 11 doesn't go, so we leave it out. 12, 5. 13 doesn't go. 14 doesn't go. 15 goes, and we put it in. And I'll just go on one bit more. That will be 3. Who can tell me first what it'll be?
45.
Thank you. 345. And we have long tables like that. We have tables of cubes. We have all sorts of other tables of arithmetic functions. And their arithmetic was such that by about 1500 BC, they could very easily solve simultaneous equations, quadratic equations, some cubics. They were computing to many, many places of sexagesimals. It is not uncommon to find calculations carried out to 8 places of sexagesimals. Now, the funny thing that happens is that very rapidly you get into 3-place numbers. I mean, for example, if we continued this, we would find that 27 would correspond to the number 2, 13, 20. Now, of course, this is a table of reciprocals. It goes both ways. The reciprocal of 2, that is 1/2, is 30. 60 over 3 is 20, and so on all the way through. If you, say, take the 640 and divide by 3, so getting our 27, 1/3 of 6 is 2, 1/3 of 40 is 13 and 1 to carry, and 1/3 of that 1 is 20. Now, you get numbers like that, and what happened was that in the course of arithmetic, just as if you're not arithmetically blocked, and I say to you, 49, you should react, that's 7 squared. You should know that automatically. It's good numbers that everybody knows. If you said 2, 13, 20 to a Babylonian, he'd know immediately that's one of nice, friendly neighborhood numbers. It's 1/27. and they had a collection of these so that they were personal friends with the first many, many prime numbers and with the factors of numbers up to three places of sexagesimals. Well, two places of sexagesimals will take you up to 60 squared, that's 3600. With three places of sexagesimals, you're up to numbers of the order of 20,000. Now, if I say to you 257, you sort of rack your brains, is it a prime number? Does it have factors? You know, if you ask the 1976, that's divisible by two, yes, what are the factors? You know, you have to sit and think about it. You don't know automatically what numbers are square or cube very easily. You don't know what numbers are good reciprocals. Does everybody know that 1, 4, 2, 8, 5, 7 is 1/7 as a recurring decimal? Many people do. Do you know what the square root of 2 is, or the cube root of 3? Some of them we know, some we don't. The Babylonians seem to have gained a terrific facility and competence in knowing the properties of numbers because they were using the largest effective number base that people have ever used. Now, when you're dealing with number bases, usually the physical conditions are such that either you want the smallest possible number base, which is 2, and which is what we use in computers, or you want the biggest number base you can handle. Now, every day of our lives, we handle 26 letters of the alphabet, upper and lowercase. There's no difficulty in knowing 60 different symbols. And it's rather silly to cut ourselves down to this mid-range of 10, especially when 10 is a nasty number, because it goes funny on us already when we get to 3. 1/3 is 0.33333. It has gone haywire already. This doesn't go haywire until 7. And 7's not a particularly useful sort of number. Neither is 11. 6 is a large number and enabled them to get a very great instant familiarity with numerals. This gave them, as a school subject, something which occupied the sort of place that Latin and Greek did educationally 100 years ago. It was something to stretch the brain on. Now, the old story of what happened in the rise of mathematics is that mathematics was developed for useful purposes.
The last word was messages. Laid
back.
The Babylonian schools were able to teach these Greek and Latin type of exercises with arithmetic, and they generated schoolwork examples. I exaggerate a little, you will recognize I do that now rather a lot just to make it vivid. You know the old sort of arithmetic example that was inflicted on your parents or grandparents about a bath with 3 different taps leading into it and 2 leaky holes, and then you're asked how many hours will it take to fill the bath. Or a ditch is dug by 3 people in 4 days, or by 4 people in so many days, how long will it take 7 men to... You know the sort of thing? Or the sort of algebra example where you have 3 bracket x into 4 plus y into bracket... You know, going on and on with brackets and brackets inside brackets. You know the sort of tedious thing that you had to work out before they invented the new mathematics that made everything easy. They used to teach mathematics by tedious example after example. We have tablets full of them. And this became a cornerstone of education. Now, it used to be thought that mathematics was developed for the useful purposes of measuring the land, paying wages, and so on. It is quite clear that man could do this very, very early on. And what is really developed is a sort of mental gymnastics exercise for the hell of it. To stretch the brain, to make things difficult, to make kids fail, and to pick out, to pick out the good ones, if you like. The mathematics that was developed of quadratic equations, of brackets within brackets, of leaky baths and people digging ditches that were physically impossible, are very clearly school exercises motivated because, like Everest, it's there, not because it is useful. It is impossible to sustain a thesis of the development of mathematics and geometry as we know it on the utilitarian argument. Within a few hundred years, so far as we can see, the Babylonian arithmetic went on far beyond anything that could be useful for another 2,000 years. Far beyond. What they got, however, was a tradition that continued. Now, it happens that there hadn't been that much excavation on the great desert territories that are now Iraq and surrounding lands. We happen to have rather good archives from about 1500 BC. We have another lot which we're piecing together but are not even published yet from about 700 BC. And then we have two or three lots from the later periods that we call Seleucid, after the kingdom of that name, from about 300, maybe 400 BC onwards. This is already into Greek and nearly Roman times. The tradition is continuous. The last person speaking and writing on these clay tablets died out in Roman times in the 1st century AD. There were still such people around after the time of Christ. But the tradition, so far as we can see from all the tablets, is quite continuous. Now, what boggles the mind is that all of their arithmetic that turns up later in astronomical theory of the utmost mathematical complexity, as good as anything that is done now in undergraduate mathematics at any level, involving things like step functions and Fourier analyses and wave functions, all sorts of really sophisticated things. This was developed in those centuries BC in a continuous tradition. We don't know by how many people. Maybe it's half a dozen people in the whole of history. Maybe it was a whole tradition. It probably was a whole school tradition. We don't know. We don't know more about it than they tell us, and they don't tell us much. We have the text. What boggles the mind is that this is a mode of thought that we have only just learned to appreciate for two reasons. Firstly, now we have the computer. The computer now teaches us that what can constitute a theory is what is known as an algorithm. When you have the formula for calculating something, then you have it, you know it. A Babylonian theory has the status of an algorithm. It says you take this number, you do that to it, you multiply this by that, you take that other number, you feed it in, and there's the whole chain of operations, and out comes the answer. And that is the thing that you expect. We don't work that way. From Greek times onwards, and indeed most of the other civilizations, we have worked by understanding something by seeing it. What is involved is essentially the difference between the domination of understanding by seeing and understanding by logical sequential operations, if you like, oral, sequential speech. Now, it happens that that difference in rational thought is something that is, in a way, still with us. Within the last year or two, there has come to the foreground, through the neurophysiologists and the behavioral psychologists, the notion that there exist centers of the left hemisphere of the brain and the right hemisphere of the brain that are essentially different, and normally, in our civilization, we use both. The hemispheres, briefly, the two halves of the brain, you know, it's two separate halves with a piece down at the base joining them together. This has little to do with left-handedness, what I'm now talking about. Handedness is something different. Being a left-hander, I believe that right-handedness is produced by brain damage. That's another matter, however. This is not the handedness, but this has something to do with those factors, either racial of nature, or environmental of nurture, or more probably some combination. There's no reason why it shouldn't be just as racial as the different structure of the hand fold in different races, which gives us pushing tools or pulling tools depending on what particular shape your body is, or things like the eye fold. I mean, this can extend equally well to peculiarities of this sort. We are not being normative. There's no question of anyone being better than another. Or it might be environmental. We just don't know. But there's one half of the brain, the left half, that is predominantly used in analytical sequential thought. I mean, if I ask you to spell Mississippi, you have to think. You will tend to use that part of your brain rather than the other part. It is verbal, it works in algorithms, it understands algorithmically. It takes things one at a time in sequence like chess moves. The other half of your brain, your right, is visual. It understands the gestalt, seeing the whole picture. Intuition is largely of that variety. When you look at something artistic, the Parthenon, you're dealing with the shape of things, with the flow. When I move my arms around like that, then I'm being right brain dominated. It's a very interesting thing. You can look at a person and diagnose which way they're thinking. If their eyes go up to the right, they're using left brain and thinking about the spelling of Mississippi. If the eyes go to the left, they're using right brain and doing something like wondering whether Denmark or the Netherlands is to the left or right on the map, you see. Those are the two modes of thought. Now, what has happened in history is that we have had civilizations that are very much the one way or very much the other. And from the time of Alexander onwards, there has been so much of both around in the world that all thinking people have done both with a certain tension and uneasiness, some being rather stronger one way than the other. It is a thing where one tends to be predominantly the one or the other, like male-female. There are relatively few people near a state of balance. So it is with left and right brain dominance. Now, the unfortunate thing, of course, is that in mathematics, where it all began, the tendency is for the efficient use to be the left hemisphere, logical sequential type of thinking, even though the majority of the population today are right hemisphere thinkers, making out with some difficulty also in the left hemisphere when demanded of them. But because of the selective power in mathematics, there is a something more than 50-50 chance that the average kid going to school will, so to speak, I'm misusing the term, but let me use it. The average kid going to school has a 50-50 chance of getting a math teacher of the wrong blood group or the wrong brain hemisphere dominance, and this is why so many bright kids get turned off mathematics. You can get turn yourself on again by taking a different mathematics teacher, preferably one that draws diagrams on the board and waves their arms around, if that has happened to you. It's a really very simple thing. Now, that is the element of logical sequential thought of a very strongly left-brain-dominated culture that turns up in this Babylonian area and thenceforth becomes the strong element. It is thanks to the Babylonians that our science is predominantly a mathematical one. The mathematical background, backbone of modern science, comes from that Babylonian heritage. It is something that ever after made science to some degree eclectic. It made science begin with astronomy and not with the very useful sciences. Again, the utilitarian argument doesn't work. You cannot say we needed astronomy for the calendar. What you need for that is very simple stuff. Now, just as the Babylonians were very good at knowing the properties of number, they were very poor at things visual. Babylonian ziggurats are not particularly square. When they built the three walls of a house and put on the fourth, likely as not it didn't meet, and you've got a funny little bit joining up the face where it didn't meet. And you can see it when you excavate their sides. Compared with, say, the Greeks or the Egyptians, are totally the other way round. When the Greeks built, they built like the Parthenon. It is perfect. But I doubt whether any Greek really knew that 11 was a prime number without counting it up on his fingers two or three times to make sure. The properties of numbers, the power of manipulating them, was like any person, and you must know people like this, that almost get a vomit reaction when they are faced with a 7x table. Or with talking about square roots or something like that. It's mathematical, I can't do it. And this is what the normal civilizations are like. It is rare that they get this strain and get it strongly. The Babylonians got it, and they got it to levels that are, if they were around today, you would call it genius phenomenal. We have mathematical geniuses, not just in calculating. It is a talent that occurs by some whim of a biological sport, a reaction that happens, like genius musicians or genius chess players. It has nothing much to do with creative ability in mathematics. But we still have with us the possibility that the human brain can go this way. There was a very famous Indian mathematician of the last century who whose mind works like this, and we still haven't been able to reproduce his thoughts. I write a little of that in Science Since Babylon. The Indian's name is Ramanujan. We have a whole civilization, or those few bits of it, that start out in pure concentrated form with this quality. It's the best argument I know for the sort of chariot of the god things. Maybe the green men came down from Mars and showed them how to do it, or put the right vitamins in their diet so that they got a load of mathematics. I mean, I'm not suggesting fantastic things like this are true, but it is a weird accident of civilization that the first sign of concentrated extensive genius of the human brain seems to have come in a powerful knowledge of arithmetic, working with a sexagesimal arithmetic that became a mathematical astronomy and was inherited by all the later civilizations, particularly the Greeks, with whom there was no real communication because their brains were thinking differently. But, of course, the final results could go over. We still have these two modes of mathematical thought. There is a minority of the world's mathematicians that are intuitors, working with intuitive proof, and they're doing the same mathematics. We have no difficulty communicating. It's the same mathematics, but a different flavor. We still have the two groups. The other group, of course, are the more normal ones who write down equations sequentially on the board and expect us all to follow and know what's happening. Most of you can't. We still have these modes. It happened right there at the beginning, and essentially it is due to that weird thing that happened and began there that our civilization, in its present form, looks so alien to all the other world civilizations. The Yellow River civilization that developed into the Chinese did not start out under this acute state of tension of having a Babylonian type of inheritance and a Greek type. Both types of thought grew up amongst the Chinese, never under tension, equably and developed, and there never was the big conflict and hassle of knowing things in two different ways that gave the zest to scientific inquiry in our particular trace of cultural evolution. The Chinese went very far, farther than any other, in developing the two lines and in developing all the technologies to go with it. Similarly, though perhaps not quite so great, the Indus Valley civilization developed also a mathematics and astronomy, all of the other things, again seemingly without a state of tension. Now, you can see the difference not merely in the arithmetic. Those of you that are familiar at all with art history, please think now of our own visual tradition of sort of Rembrandt to Picasso, and compare the sort of impact on the eye with the art that goes with our left hemisphere Babylonian types. I don't suppose you will have much in your mind's eye of Babylonian and Assyrian art, but you all should know Hindu sculpture, the Mayan glyphs of South America. Their art object, these glyphs, this picture language, their decorations, this is an artwork that is designed to be read logical sequentially. You look at the picture and the elements of it tell you something. You read them in order. You don't sweep your eyes over the picture. You go blop, 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 and take in the elements, put them in order, involve, it's almost like seeing a slow movie of a chess game. When you look at a selection of Mayan glyphs, you are expected to make an algorithm for yourself to go from one to the other. The people who did that would be so pleased to be able to read a modern computer program. It is their sort of literature. Now, if you know any of these whiz kids of computer programming who have a different sort of brain than most people, these are the Babylonians of our age. And their art, if they could but read it, is the art of the computer program, which is exactly that of the Hindu sculpture, of the Mayan glyphs, and the few other world languages that have been of that variety. Now, we are a mishmash, after many centuries of development, of the two lines. It's difficult for us to sort it out, but predominantly, because of the Renaissance, we have sent ourselves back to the Golden Age of Greece with its right hemisphere, visual, intuitive type of thinking. And when we want something explained, we have to see it. We see explanations. Your computer programmer does not see an explanation. He records the algorithm. That is for him the explanation, or her. It's not a sex-bound quality at all. Well, that is the story of the Babylonian beginning. As I say, I find it fascinating. I would like you to read more of that culture, which you'll do in the Kramer and Kiera books, and particularly to learn something of the mathematics of it. Now, I have a little while for questions. Yes?
Did the Babylonians have any placeholder zero type thing?
Thank you for reminding me of that. He asked about whether they have a zero. There is a place value thing. And in many of the old books, They have some absurd statement that the Indians invented the sign for zero, and that's a big thing in arithmetic. This is a load of baloney. It's a story that was made up, like the story was made up about the Egyptians measuring land after the flood. What the Babylonians do originally is to write what I put as, say, 1-2, that is 62. Originally, they would write it like that, spaced. Now, if you want to do 1-0-2, which is one lot of 60 times 60, no lots of 60, and 2 units, you see, they would write it not like that, but like that. And later on, they would put some sort of sign. Any old thing would do. There are various conventions for various scribes in the blank space in the middle. Later, this got conventionalized. It is exactly equivalent to our zero. And it is, in fact, not a very important thing. It is not important in the manipulation or handling of numbers. Sure, they sometimes make mistakes with computation, but they never make a mistake through slipping a place, or they do not often make such a mistake. Does that answer you? Yeah.
You mentioned the Mayan glyphs.
Yeah.
The Asians who crossed the Bering Strait bring across any of the Chinese math culture with them?
No, there is a theory that the Mayan culture comes from some sort of Asian transmittal, but we do not know enough to confirm or deny this. It is a more or less wild conjecture, and although there are some similarities in the Mayan calendrical astronomy, it is at such a simple level that it is difficult to link with anything in the Asian stuff. By the way, there is a certain tendency to mythologize the past and speak about the wonderful accurate astronomy of the Mayans, just as we speak about the glorious technology of the Egyptians. I'm afraid it's another one of the great myths of history, like the ride of Paul Revere. It just didn't happen that way. The essential accuracy of Mayan astronomy is no more remarkable than the extraordinary accuracy of our week system, where Wednesday always follows Tuesday and we never make a mistake. The whole of Mayan astronomy is nothing more than a set of cycles like our week cycles, and there is no fantastic correspondence with astronomical phenomena, nor indeed astronomical observation. I will talk about that next week. There is a fairly simple and expectable system of basic astronomy. The Mayans are rather far-fetched with their multiply interlocked cycles, but it does not match well enough anything we know from Asia. It is, so far as we can see, an independent culture.
How would you think the Babylonian society would have developed if they had not had so much mathematics, but had been, say, right-brained almost entirely?
I don't know. What would you have been like if you were twins? Or a girl? Or if you had been born an Ethiopian instead of an American? I mean, what the hell do you do with a question like that?
I'm saying, you said that the mathematics wasn't that useful. Wasn't that necessary.
No.
Could they have survived with just the other?
As well as we could have survived without Picasso, or without Bernard Shaw, or Shakespeare, or Chaucer, or without Einstein. It would have been different. That sort of as-if history I find very difficult. Exactly the same system goes into their law code. There's a very strong correlation between the concept of natural law and of human law. And if you think of it, they have a computer code for a law code. The code of Hammurabi, the biblical code of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is practically something that you could feed to a computer and have it act like a judge. Say, if so-and-so, then so-and-so. This is what a computer does. Now, that is the same as their mathematical system, their concept of explanation and of theory. The Greek need was to see the circumstances of a person, to make a melting together of all of the forces. This is exactly the sort of higher theory that goes into everything we know of Plato and Aristotle. It's very different. They would have been different people. It's very difficult to answer a question in the terms that you couch it. Yeah.
And how much is cultural?
No, we don't know. I think we're getting near it, and there have been some recent tests within the last year. It's almost at the level of pseudoscience, but with some good hard things in it, and I'm dramatizing a little. The essential thing seems to be that this is not something that happens at birth, but in about the second or third year of development, as the brain develops rather late in the human animal, and it's and man is a peculiar animal in this respect, in going through a cerebral evolution so late in life as the second or third year after birth, the brain begins to specialize, and it seems to be a matter of whether the one thing develops before another. When people are adolescing wildly, there are some who fill out here before they fill out there, and with others it's the other way round. Okay? Now, with some people, it would seem as if the visual centers develop so well first that this becomes the central matrix in terms of which the rest of the brain impressions are ordered and centralized. With other people, it is the other part that develops first. Now, this may be genetic. As I said, in fact, I would not be surprised if it were as genetic as handfold or eyefold in being different between races. This is very politically hot stuff to talk about racial differences that affect brains. This is used as a political put-down, and I'm not going to step myself right in that one. It could be equally well something as simple as the diet. A diet of a certain sort, protein-rich or lacking a vitamin, could easily unbalance the development and make one thing develop more than another. From the rarity of it, it would seem to be the Babylonian type that is singularly rare, and the Earth's history is peculiar in the fact that the human race went once this way out of its four beginnings. There is another mystery, by the way. It turns out that from flint tools, that at some times in history, in the Neolithic, the majority of people in many of the sites were left-handed rather than right. Now, whether there has been a flip-over in this, we don't know the genetics or the nature and nurture balance for left-handedness. For situs invertus, that is when your heart's on the right instead of the left and everything flips over. This happens too, but it's rarer than left-handedness. And we don't know about the factors controlling the left-right brain dominance. We do know, however, that there's a strong tendency for one of the hemispheres to be dominant and to become the coordinating force for the rest. Okay? And more than that, we don't know. By the time you're teaching, maybe we'll know it. Yeah?
And also, how recent an idea is the idea of the left brain and the right
brain? It was put up by Ornstein in a book, I think, about 4 years ago, and has been written a lot at the popular level. There have begun to be half a dozen a year really serious researches on it, and I believe the first international conference on the topic from a proper scholarly point of view is scheduled for next year. But what intrigues me is that it fits extremely well with the stuff that we have long known about the utterly different character of Babylonian mathematics and the Greek mathematics. As you'll hear, it is this, the putting together of the two quite different sorts of mathematical need of the way you think that produces what we have and what has made modern science and technology and has made us the rather peculiar sort of civilization. Any other? Yes?
So you mentioned that the Babylonian culture was different than the Egyptian and the Greek culture, and that the Greeks and Egyptians were more right-brained and thought more in terms of
normal. And they're more normal.
And algorithmic and sequential way. The written language of the Egyptians, the hieroglyphics were sequential pictorialic, and I believe the linear
edge
of the Greeks was very similar to
The Sumerian Babylonian languages are not that much different from any of the other world languages as they develop. I do not think this is a matter of linguistic development, although it may well be that the very heavy grammatical structure that goes into these Semitic languages has something to do with it. I mean, languages like, especially the Greek, are communicating by picture building. Sumerian, Akkadian, you could put straight on a computer much more easily than you could put English or Greek. English or Greek's very difficult simply because we're thinking differently. But I do not think that it shows up nearly so much in the language as it does with the operation with numerals, where it develops very strongly and where we can still see that there is enormous emotional pressure and a widespread inhuman ability. And we still have that built in of a much wider spread in the ability of people to cope with numbers, especially because of this two types of orientation which gets mismatched in the teaching process. Since we have this so strongly, I believe it to be still very much with us and to be a possibility that a brain comes out either the one way or the other. You know, like Gilbert and Sullivan, every little boy or girl born into the world alive is either a little liberal or a little conservative. Well, it's either a left brain or a right brain that you go, if you go at all. I mean, if you become thinking, then you're very much the one way or the other. And we do use both. You can see people doing both by watching their eye pupils. It's a crazy, remarkable thing that the activity of the brain does cause an unbalance of the very sensitive muscular balance of the eyes. So you can see, you know, when people look up to heaven for the answers, they look up one way for that type of answer and the other way for the other. And it works. It's so zany that the two lots of people found it, and both of them refrained from publication because they thought it silly. But then they found each other and found they consistently had these results, and they published, and it's now been used diagnostically. And I would think that before a few years we'll have rather valuable researchers from this go around practicing and seeing whether people are thinking like a computer or thinking in pictures. And you'll find that most people are doing both, and you can really catch them daydreaming in pictures or day logical spinning. Okay, I think that's it. Don't forget, by tomorrow, you'll...